that's just human nature. It's survival. Desperate people do desperate things. It's not a question of being loyal or patriotic. F*** that. We're a nation of strangers. If any country was a country, a nation of strangers, it's the United States. Because the last thing we are is united. So, don't let them trouble you. I hope you can make up any revenue you might have lost from those mukes who felt, because they can't do what you do, engage in retribution and spite. F*** them and the horse they rode in on.
Wow.
You do what you have to do. And by the way, that's not to say you can't continue your show, that you can't broadcast to people in America from a different country. Technology exists to do that.
Yeah, not only that, I've done it. And there have been stretches of time where I've been out of the U.S. and I didn't announce it because there was no reason to announce it, but nobody had any idea. It's not really a question of being able to do the show. So let's hope that that's the final note on this leaving the country thing. I have no plan to leave the country. We will talk on today's bonus show about the resignation of CNN's president over a consensual relationship with an employee. We will talk about a push to make the Lunar New Year a federal holiday. And we will actually talk about jury deliberations in the Roy Moore defamation case. Remember, this is the bonus show. Much maligned by Alex Jones.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Right. What an endorsement. And I invite you to sign up at joinpacman.com. You'll get instant access, and I will see you on.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth. The cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house! Bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Events that brought us right up to the edge of a real coup in America.
As Donald Trump openly admits he tried to overturn the 2020 election, we'll speak to Congressmember Jamie Raskin, who serves on the House Select Committee on the January 6th attack. He's the subject of a new MSNBC documentary called Love and the Constitution, which gives an inside view of how the Maryland Democrat responded to twin tragedies in the weeks after the 2020 election, the attempted coup, and the suicide of his own son.
We were not the only family in that god-awful year to lose a family member. If you add up COVID-19, opioid deaths, gun violence, and all of the other normal causes, millions of people lost loved ones.
Amen.
We are indeed surrounded now by American carnage.
Then to Chicago, where protests erupted Thursday over the early release of the ex-police officer Jason Van Dyke, who murdered 17-year-old Laquan McDonald in 2014, shooting him 16 times.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
We'll speak with Will Calloway, who pushed for the release of the police video of McDonald's murder. We'll also talk to Justin Blake, the uncle of Jacob Blake, who was shot by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Blake and Calloway were both detained last night, calling for federal civil charges against the officer. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's confirmed the death of Islamic State leader Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureishi, who reportedly died as U.S. warplanes, helicopters and special forces assaulted a residential compound in northwest Syria Thursday. Biden blamed Qureishi for the deaths of at least 13 people, including women and children, who were killed during Thursday's early morning raid.
As our troops approached to capture the terrorist, in a final act of desperate cowardice, he, with no regard to the lives of his own family or others in the building, he chose to blow himself up, not just to the vest, but to blow up that third floor, rather than face justice for the crimes he has committed, taking several members of his family with him, just as his predecessor did.
Witnesses described a gruesome scene inside the partially destroyed compound with six children and four women among the dead. Images showed remnants of U.S.-made explosive devices scattered near the site of the assault. Thursday's raid came less than a week after Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin directed the military to do more to protect civilians from harm in U.S. drone strikes and other combat operations. Russian President Vladimir Putin has met Chinese leader Xi Jinping for talks in Beijing, coinciding with the start of the Winter Olympic Games. It was President Xi's first face-to-face meeting with another world leader in nearly 2 years due to the pandemic. In a joint statement, Putin and Xi called for an end to NATO expansion in Eastern Europe and blasted the newly formed AUKUS military alliance between the United States, United Kingdom, and Australia. Xi and Putin also discussed a deal on a new pipeline that would ship Russian gas to China. The Biden administration's accused Russia of fabricating a pretext to invade Ukraine. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said Thursday he has evidence the Russian government is planning to stage a false flag operation by producing a propaganda video falsely incriminating Ukraine's military or intelligence forces for attacks.
A video with graphic scenes of false explosions, depicting corpses, crisis actors pretending to be mourners, and images of destroyed locations or military equipment, entirely fabricated by Russian intelligence.
The claims drew skepticism from reporters. This is Associated Press of diplomatic writer Matt Lee questioning Ned Price.
Crisis actors, really? This is like Alex Jones territory you're getting into now. What evidence do you have to support the idea that there is some propaganda film in the making?
Matt, this is derived from information known to the U.S. government, intelligence information that we have declassified. I think you know.
Okay, well, where is it? Where is this information?
It is intelligence information that we have declassified.
Well, where is it? Where is the declassified information?
I just delivered it.
Russia's foreign minister dismissed the claims as total disinformation and once again denied Russia's planning to invade Ukraine. Global coronavirus infections have begun to decline from record highs set in late January as new infections from the Omicron variant continue to fall in the United States and much of Europe. Countries worldwide are still reporting more than 3 million infections and over 10,000 deaths per day. In South Africa, workers at a technology transfer hub launched by the World Health Organization have produced the continent's first ever domestically produced doses of mRNA vaccines. The Afrigen Biologics vaccine candidate was produced using a publicly available reverse-engineered sequence of Moderna's COVID vaccine. It was produced without the assistance and approval of Moderna or Pfizer-BioNTech after the drug companies refused to transfer technology for the life-saving vaccines to countries in the global south. In Chicago, the former police officer who shot and killed black teenager Laquan McDonald in 2014 walked free from prison Thursday. Jason Van Dyke, who is white, served little over 3 years, less than half his nearly 7-year prison sentence, before being released for good behavior. Van Dyke shot 17-year-old Laquan McDonald 16 times, but the Chicago Police Department attempt to cover up the events at the time with the help of then-Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Activists are now calling for federal charges against Van Dyke. Several protests took place in Chicago yesterday, including in front of the Federal Plaza. This is Bishop Tavis Grant of the Rainbow Push Coalition.
We know that night 12 officers were on the scene who did not render any aid to Laquan McDonald, and he died on the street. We know that reports were falsified. We know that witnesses were tampered with. And we know that the video was suppressed by the city hall for over 400 days. 16 shots and a cover-up.
Reverend Jesse Jackson was also present. He hand-delivered a letter to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago backing the call for federal charges. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with community organizer Will Calloway, who pushed for the release of the police video showing Laquan McDonald's murder. We'll also be joined by Justin Blake, the uncle of Jacob Blake. Here in New York City, President Biden met with Mayor Eric Adams Thursday on a visit to discuss efforts to reduce gun violence. Eric Adams, a former police captain, ran on a law and order platform. Biden spoke during a news conference at NYPD headquarters with Adams, Governor Kathy Hochul, and New York lawmakers.
Mayor Adams, you and I agree. The answer is not to abandon our streets. That's not the answer. The answer is to come together, the police and communities, building trust and making us all safer. The answer is not to defund the police. It's to give you the tools, the training, the funding to be partners, to be protectors, and community needs you.
At least one refugee drowned and 16 others are missing at sea after their boat capsized off the Canary Islands Wednesday night. About 40 other refugees were rescued. Meanwhile, at least 12 refugees froze to death on the Greece-Turkey border Wednesday. Turkey's interior minister accused Greek border guards of expelling the refugees back into Turkey after taking their shoes and stripping them of some of their clothing. Greece denies the claims as false propaganda. In Mission, Texas, the National Butterfly Center is closing down indefinitely after facing years of harassment from right-wing groups. In 2019, the Conservation Center sued the Trump administration and the group We Build the Wall to prevent construction of the U.S.-Mexico border wall on its property. Right-wing groups proceeded to smear the National Butterfly Center and started a conspiracy theory that the nonprofit facilitates human trafficking and sex trafficking. The center says it hopes to reopen as soon as it becomes safe for its staff and visitors. In a historic victory for international labor rights, thousands of Mexican workers at a General Motors plant in the city of Silao have voted to form an independent union. Thursday's union election was the first ever since the implementation of new labor reforms in Mexico written into the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. Many powerful unions in Mexico with ties to elite politicians and business people had for years gone behind workers' backs to make deals with multinational corporations to keep workers' pay low and deny them other benefits. With an independent union, GM workers in Silao have now broken ties with one of Mexico's most influential labor organizations, which had held the plant's contract for 25 years. And in Nicaragua, the criminal trials of dozens of opponents of President Daniel Ortega's government, including students, journalists, activists, and political leaders, resumed this week. Several have been convicted after trials that lasted less than a day and had been delayed for months. They were jailed last year leading up to November's election, where Ortega won a fourth term. This is the mother of Yasser Vado Gonzalez, a member of the opposition party UNAMOS, who was convicted Tuesday.
It makes no sense for it to go on like this. There has to be a solution for this problem, for this conflict we are going through. There has to be a solution between the state of Nicaragua, the government, and the citizens. Many mothers are suffering, wives and children too. As a mother, I understand all of their feelings.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Congressmember Jamie Raskin. Stay with us. You put your finest suit on. I paint my fingernails. Oh, we're going out in style, babe. And everything's on sale. We creep up on extinction. I pull your arms right in. I weep and say, As the World Caves In by Matt Maltese. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As more details emerge about the deadly January 6th insurrection and how Donald Trump and his allies plotted to overturn the 2020 election, we begin today's show with Congressmember Jamie Raskin, Democrat from Maryland. Raskin serves on the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack. He was the lead manager in the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump following the insurrection. Congressmember Raskin was inside the House January 6th, as were his daughter and son-in-law, when Trump supporters attacked the Capitol. The January 6th insurrection came at a tragic moment for the Raskin family. Just days earlier, Jamie Raskin's 25-year-old son, Tommy, died by suicide. He was a student at Harvard Law School. Raskin writes about these events in his new memoir titled Unthinkable: Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy. There's also a new documentary about Congressmember Jamie Raskin titled Love and the Constitution, airing Sunday night on MSNBC. This is the film's trailer.
Some of our members started to say, Trump's not worth it. The president's not worth it. The question is whether the Constitution is worth it. I know one thing really well, which is about the Constitution and the rule of law in American democracy. It's like everybody knows one thing, and my turn came up. I did not know whether I would be able to do anything again of meaning or substance in my life.
Voltaire said, anyone who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities.
Democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed.
Tommy was a person who loved the world and he loved democracy. I feel like I honor him by doing the work that he'd be proud of.
The trailer to Love and the Constitution, directed by Madeline Carter, who began work on the documentary in 2018. Carter was filming inside Congressmember Jamie Raskin's home on election night 2020 and captured this moment when he spoke with his son Tommy as results came in.
Tom,
hey.
Are you staying up or are you going to sleep?
He is losing votes in the crucial Milwaukee suburb.
I don't think so. I'd be willing to put money on it.
Then I think it's going to be a headway for him to win the state of Wisconsin.
Hey, yeah, I'll bet you.
To
the
kind of result
for
those
guys.
If Trump wins, I get money.
Okay.
All right. Love you, kiddo.
Bye. My kids are so freaked out that Trump might win. Everybody's so freaked out.
Different than Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan.
I mean, it's going to be a long night. Trump is going to be suing. We're going to win this narrowly, and then Trump is going to be fighting it every step along the way. Buckle up. We'll be fighting about this until we get into the new Congress. We'll be fighting about it until January 6th.
Congressmember Jamie Raskin speaking on election night 2020 in a clip from Love and the Constitution. Trump's efforts to overturn the election would soon begin. In the documentary, Raskin goes on to talk about Trump's efforts to overturn the election.
The country is still just trying to absorb the emotional impact of events that brought us right up to the edge of a real coup in America. We can't have healing before we have an honest reckoning, and this president must be held accountable for the role he has played.
We'll be joined by the film's director, Madeline Carter, later in the program. But first, we go to Tacoma Park, Maryland, to speak with Congressmember Jamie Raskin. He's represented Maryland's 8th congressional district since 2017. He's also married to Sarah Bloom Raskin, who has been nominated by President Biden to become the top banking regulator at the Federal Reserve and underwent serious grilling yesterday. Congressmember Jamie Raskin, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us.
It's great to be with you, Amy, and thank you for having me.
So the name of your book is Unthinkable, Trauma, Truth, and the present trauma, Unthinkable, Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy. You were the lead impeachment manager in President Trump's second impeachment trial. You're a member of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection, which is where I want to start, actually, even before January 6th, because you were right there in the house when the attack took place. And I want to take this sequentially, how this went. I mean, you were already reeling, even if that hadn't happened, because your son, Tommy, and I want to offer my condolences to your whole family, because I haven't had a chance to talk to you personally in this last year, took his own life on New Year's Eve. So you were there with your family, some members, your daughter, and now your son-in-law. And you decided to go January 6th for the certification of the vote because it was that important to you. Can you talk about that moment? Can you talk about those days and what happened next?
Well, it was, of course, a constitutional responsibility for me to be there, for the whole Congress to be there. It's in the 12th Amendment that the first Wednesday in January, Congress meets in joint session just to receive the Electoral College votes. We knew that Trump was doing everything in his power to try to overturn the election, as he said just this last weekend. First, they were in a relatively legitimate sphere when they went to more than 60 different courts, federal and state courts, to allege electoral fraud and corruption. And every court rejected their claims. That's what creates a comprehensive documentary record that their whole attack on the election, the big lie, is based on a tissue of propaganda and nonsense. But then they moved, they escalated into increasingly illegitimate things, trying to get the state legislatures to void the popular vote and substitute in Trump Electoral College slates, then going to election officials, several dozen of them, most prominently Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger in Georgia, to try to intimidate them and browbeat them into concocting a victory for Trump, making up votes. In that case, you know, just find me 11,780 votes. And from there, he moved to the plan, which they ended up not going forward with because they couldn't get any department to cooperate, but they wanted to seize the election machinery. And from there, the attack was on Michael Flynn. And this was something that we had predicted, that they would try to get Flynn to announce extra constitutional powers, powers outside of the Constitution, to unilaterally reject and repudiate Electoral College votes coming in from the states, specifically Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. So Speaker Pelosi had tasked me and a few other members with the job of getting ready to answer the objections to particular the receipt of particular Electoral College votes. And, you know, as I described in the book, Amy, basically we had prepared for everything except for a violent insurrection overrunning the House and the Senate.
Now, it's not like Congressmember Raskin, it's not like you didn't have a warning. Well, I want to go back to another clip from the new MSNBC documentary, Love and the Constitution, beginning with Donald Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, testifying before you, testifying in Congress in 2019.
Given my experience working for Mr. Trump, I fear that if he loses the election in 2020, that there will never be a peaceful transition of power. And this is why I agreed to appear before you today.
Michael Cohen did issue a stark warning to the country that if Donald Trump lost, there would be no peaceful transition. There's no way he would accept it.
That is a frightening and startling thing for the president's own lawyer to say about him.
But it seemed far off at that point to a lot of people. And people have said from the beginning, there's no way he would do that. There's no way anybody would do that.
So that is Congressmember Jamie Raskin. And at the end, you're shaking the hand of Mr. Cohen. But you didn't quite believe what he was saying. Is that right?
Oh, actually, when I looked at some of the footage that Mads Carter had filmed, I was saying there are some other parts of the movie where I was saying there will be violence all the way up till January 6th. And I was sort of amazed that I kept predicting that. But what I hadn't predicted was that it would be so overwhelming that we wouldn't be able to stop it. I mean, the image, when Tabitha and Hank decided to come with me, and of course we were all absolutely devastated on January 6th because we had buried Tommy on January the 5th in a COVID-19, you know, funeral where we could only have 20 people there. And when they decided to come with me, they said, well, will we be okay? Because Donald Trump is telling his people to come to Washington. And I said, of course we'll be all right. We'll be inside the Capitol. And the image I had in my mind, Amy, was of June the 2nd, when Black Lives Matter had a protest at the Capitol. And there was this huge phalanx of National Guardsmen and women holding, you know, bayonets and weapons on the steps of the Capitol. And that was immediately the image that came to mind. That was the day after Trump and William Barr had unleashed that paramilitary police riot against protesters in Lafayette Square. And essentially, you know, what I hadn't seen was that we would not be militarily prepared sufficiently to defend the Capitol building, the House and the Senate, and that there would be this band of violent extremists, white nationalists, Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, militiamen. There were Aryan Nations there that came to lead the mob and smashed out our windows and began the assault on the police officers. And that was the part that was not foreseen. I mean, I, like most members of Congress, I was walking around with the assurance in my mind that if one person tried to evade the metal detectors and to run into the Capitol, they would be shot on sight. And we were overrun by more than 900 rioters who came in. And like Lindsey Graham said that day, we all could have died because any one of them could have had a bomb. And we're lucky that the Secret Service at Trump's rally were checking people for weapons, because that's why most of the extremists left their arms back in the car or back in the hotel or motel, because they were going to that rally. But had they not, it could have been a very different situation, and there would have been a lot more deaths than there were. I mean, it was a deadly riot as it was, but that riot surrounded an insurrection, and that insurrection surrounded, of course, a coup whose details are surfacing now through our investigation.
And I want to talk about those details, but you were separated from your daughter, Tabitha, and from Hank, now your son-in-law, right, because you were on the floor of the House. Talk about where you went and your fear for them, where they went.
Well, Hank, by the way, was my son-in-law then. He had eloped in a COVID-19 wedding with our daughter, Hannah. He's married to our older daughter, and they had an Elvis Presley wedding out in Nevada. But they wanted to see me speak, which was nice. And they saw the speeches that I was giving, defending the Electoral College count and explaining what our constitutional role was. We were not there to pick the president. We were simply there to receive the Electoral College votes from the states as they had been cast essentially by the people of the states. But after that was over, they wanted to go back to Steny's office. Steny Hoyer had offered his Capitol Hill office, and they went back there. And so when we were overrun and the siege began, I was separated from them, and they were with my chief of staff, Julie Tagan. They barricaded themselves in the Steny's office. They locked the door, and then they pushed all the furniture up against the door, and Tabitha and Hank were hiding under a desk for a few hours while people were pounding on the door, and they could hear the riot taking place outside.
And yet you have so many denying what took place, even though they themselves were threatened like you were. I want to talk about the latest developments and what you think is the most significant revelations to come out of your committee right now. Those who have testified, those who haven't. Vice President Pence has not yet testified, but Mark Short, his chief of staff, has testified, we've learned, not to mention others. For example, we'll talk about what happened this week. You had testimony from a prison.
Yeah, we did.
Can you talk about this?
Well, you know, as I was saying, you know, I view it as taking place in three rings of activity, and each one is fascinating and important to understand in its own respect. I mean, there was a mass demonstration for a wild protest called by Donald Trump that turned into a riot. And so that's a very important thing for us to understand, how a demonstration became a riot and how a crowd became a mob and the role that social media played in that. The realm of the insurrection with the domestic violent extremist groups, how they were coordinated and what kinds of contacts they had with the immediate political entourage surrounding Donald Trump. But at the very red hot core of it was the realm of the coup. And it's a strange word to use in American political parlance because we don't have a lot of experience with coups in our own country. And we think of a coup as something taking place against a president, but this was a coup orchestrated by the president against the vice president and against the Congress in order to overthrow the normal constitutional order and the workings of our electoral process to seize the presidency for another 4 years. And from everything I've seen so far, I am convinced that Donald Trump was absolutely hell-bent on staying in office. This was not some kind of accidental, improvisational thing that got out of control at a big demonstration. No, this was methodical and organized. And they really were depending on Mike Pence just to negate these Electoral College votes, which, of course, he had no power to do. But that would have activated under the 12th Amendment a so-called contingent election where we would move as the House of Representatives to vote immediately a new president in. And you ask, well, why would they want the House to be voting with Speaker Pelosi in charge? Well, under the 12th Amendment, we're not voting one member, one vote. We're voting one state, one vote. And after the 2020 elections, they knew well. They had 27 state delegations in the House. We had 22. Pennsylvania was tied right down the middle. Even had they lost the at-large representative from Wyoming's vote, Liz Cheney's vote, as I think they would have, they still would have had 26 votes. They would have moved immediately under the terms of the 12th Amendment for a vote. They kept talking about, well, returning the votes to the states, letting the states, giving them time, giving them weeks and months. I think they understood there would have been an immediate vote in the House of Representatives, and they would have declared victory for Trump. He likely would have invoked the Insurrection Act and declared martial law, as his disgraced former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn was urging him to do. And he would have called in the National Guard that had been held at bay for several hours over the course of the rioting to come in and put down the insurrectionary chaos he had unleashed against us. And he would have pronounced himself a hero for doing that. And I think we were very close to that having happened. And any number of things could have gone in a number of different directions that would have led to that outcome. And anything could have happened there with an insurrection and a coup. There could have been civil war in the country.
So what did you learn this week about the founder and leader of the far-right Oath Keepers, the militia group, who appeared from prison? He's facing sedition charges. And Stuart Rhodes, what did he testify and what connections do you believe he has to either Trump or Trump's inner circle?
Well, I'm afraid I can't answer that, Amy. Forgive me. We haven't released that transcript yet. The chair has not made the decision to do that. So we can't talk about the details of specific interviews and depositions until the committee's made them public.
I want to bring Madeleine Carter into this conversation, the director of the documentary that's going to be airing on MSNBC at 10 o'clock Eastern on Sunday night. Following the life and political journey of you, of Congressmember Jamie Raskin, Madeleine, can you talk about when you decided to do this film?
I spent months trying to convince Jamie to do this film. And I think I started trying to convince him in January of 2018. And I didn't start filming till July 4th of 2018.
And what was most important to you then? In fact, Congressmember Raskin is your congressmember.
That is true. Well, what had happened is that on the same day, same month, January of 2017, Donald Trump became my president and Jamie Raskin became my congressman. And literally from the early weeks, Jamie became a Trump gadfly. And I watched Jamie as he was valiantly trying to bring the public light to Trump's endless atrocities and law breaking. And so about a year into both of their terms, I thought I'd really like to make a film about Jamie kind of holding up democracy against Trump.
I want to go back to another clip of your film, Love and the Constitution.
Why is America such an extraordinary country? We are not unified by virtue of being one ethnicity, or one ideology, or one religion. We're unified by one constitution and one rule of law, and then the values under our constitution. It is an aspiration. It's a challenge to us. The Constitution shouldn't be some kind of fetish document. It should be the living commitment that we all have to make democracy work in service of the common good.
There you have a clip of the film Love and the Constitution. How did your film change over these just few years? You've been working on this now for 4 years, from when you started to what it has become.
It changed radically. When I started, Mueller and his team had been investigating for about a year. And I and many others expected that the Mueller report would come out some point in the summer or fall of 2018. And I expected that that would lead to the House Judiciary Committee investigating and impeaching Trump. And Jamie, of course, was on the House Judiciary Committee. So when I started out, I thought I was going to make a one-year film, you know, following the impeachment of Trump. Sort of through the eyes of Jamie, who was on the House Judiciary Committee. But of course, things did not happen that way, and other things kept happening. So I just kept filming because I kept not having an ending.
But you ultimately did. I mean, at this point, what has happened January 6th, to say the least, has not been resolved.
That is true. And to this day, to tell you the truth, I wish I were still making the film and still following Jamie as he is working on the January 6th Select Committee. But there may never be an ending to our Trump woes. So maybe I'll have to do a part two.
I want to go to the final clip that we have from the film Love and the Constitution. This is Congressmember Raskin reflecting on the death of Tommy, his son, and the pandemic.
We were not the only family in that god-awful year to lose a family member. If you add up COVID-19, opioid deaths, gun violence, and all of the other normal causes, millions of people lost loved ones.
Amen.
We are indeed surrounded now by American carnage.
American carnage, which of course is echoing President Trump's inaugural address. Jamie Raskin, can you talk about what happened and how that has shaped all that you have done? It was incredibly brave of you, after losing your son, to move forward and be at the center of both the impeachment, the chief impeachment manager, and then, of course, a chief congressmember on the January 6th Select Committee.
Well, I just felt that I had no choice. I felt Tommy was with me. He was in my heart. I felt him in my chest. And those were scary days because we didn't know which way things were going. I mean, the extreme right websites were continuing to agitate for finishing the job. There were death threats flying all over the place. And I felt then, as I do now, that democracy is on the line and in danger. And
you know, for most of the history of our species, people have lived under kings and queens and bullies like Donald Trump. Democracy, as Lincoln said, is a very fragile experiment. And, you know, every generation's got to ask whether government of the people, by the people, and for the people is going to perish from the earth, because you could very easily do that. And the enemies of democracy all over the world, including in America, including people like Steve Bannon, are agitating for the destruction of democracy, or what they call the deep state, based on government by the people, as opposed to dictators and would-be dictators like Donald Trump. So,
Are we going to see Donald Trump come before the committee, and are we going to see public hearings? I mean, can you talk about how the Watergate hearings affected you and how significant they were for the country and what it would mean to have the same thing today around January 6th?
Well, the Watergate hearings had a cleansing effect on at least the psyche of the country. I don't know that it fully dislodged all of the structures of power that had been mobilized against democracy. We have to have hearings that give people the truth. You know, my dad used to say that democracy needs a ground to stand on, and that ground is the truth. So the people have to be aware of exactly what took place so we can fortify our institutions and our processes against the next coup, against the next violent insurrection. You know, people understand the way that Donald Trump exploited these domestic violent extremist groups, these white nationalist groups, but they exploited him too. They used him. I mean, when they had their Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in August of 2017, they could only muster together 500 people. They were much more isolated. And then after several years of Trump and Trump's own organizing for January 6th, they were several thousand at the front of a march of 40 or 50,000 people. And they almost knocked over the government of the United States. And, you know, if you look at what they say, their only regret is they didn't bring all of their guns with them, and they left them back in their hotel and motel rooms.
Jamie, what concerns do you have for the upcoming elections? The New York Times recently reported that nearly two dozen Republicans who've publicly questioned or disputed the 2020 election results are running for secretaries of state across the country.
Well, Trump and his forces clearly want to seize the electoral apparatus. So they will be the ones making all of the decisions about which votes count and which votes don't count. It's not only an obvious plan, it's an explicit plan on their part. I mean, one of my colleagues, Jody Heiss from Georgia, is leaving the Congress of the United States to run for Secretary of State in Georgia to oust Raffensperger, who they, of course, accuse of disloyalty to the Trump regime. So that's where we are right now. So we can't fight the last battle alone. We got to fight the last battle too. We got to fortify the Congress and the presidential electoral process the best we can. But we've got to be fighting in every state to try to defend the neutral administration of the election laws and traditions of nonpartisan or at least bipartisan election administration, which they want to replace with partisan election administration. And in some places, they just want the state legislature in Republican hands to be controlling the election. So we've got to deal with that threat, which is an overwhelming one, as well as do whatever we can to defend the right to vote, even though they have used the filibuster as one of their anti-democratic instruments to prevent us from passing voting rights legislation. So what we've got really is the will of the majority. Remember, Hillary beat him by 3 million votes. Joe Biden beat him by 7.5 million votes. And our numbers are growing, and it's the will of the majority versus a bag of tricks that they've got: the voter suppression, the gerrymandering of our districts, manipulation of the Electoral College and planting booby traps throughout it, and then just stealing elections, which is what this whole attack on election administration is all about.
Finally, Congressmember Raskin, could you comment on the hearing yesterday around your wife being confirmed to the Federal Reserve? The Washington Post described Sarah Bloom Raskin is championed by Democrats eager to install a bank regulator with a focus on climate change, criticized by Republicans who don't believe climate change belongs in conversations about the financial system or economic stability. It was a serious grilling in the Senate Banking Committee.
Right. And well, let's just say this. I wasn't there and I had some hearings of my own, so I only caught parts of it. But Sarah has been unanimously or near unanimously confirmed by the U.S. Senate in bipartisan fashion twice as a governor of Federal Reserve Board and also as deputy secretary of the United States Treasury. So none of this is about her qualifications to serve, obviously, because the Senate itself has approved and confirmed her two times before. All of this is about things that she has said or written about climate change. She has said, of course, that she will follow the law and act completely within the dual mandate of the Fed. But what they're attacking is the idea that there can be citizens who are fully aware of climate change, who take it seriously, who can serve honorably and lawfully in other capacities. It's just an outrageous attack on her qualifications, of course, but she's tough. But on just the idea that you can even be cognizant of climate change and serve in different governmental functions. It's an amazing thing.
Well, Democratic Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, husband of Sarah Bloom Raskin, member of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection, lead impeachment manager in President Trump's second impeachment trial. Jamie Raskin's new book is Unthinkable: Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy. I also want to end by asking Madeline Carter, the director of the new MSNBC documentary Love and the Constitution, which is premiering Sunday night, what you want people to take away from and why you named the film Love and the Constitution.
Well, what I want people to take away is that one person can make a difference. I mean, Jamie is making a huge difference in democracy and in saving constitutional democracy. But one person can make a difference just by driving a neighbor to the polls. So there's plenty of work to be done by all of us. So that's my main message. And then in terms of naming it Love and the Constitution, I actually thought of that title at about 2 a.m. One morning in October, because that really describes what the film is about. The film is about Jamie's love for his son, obviously, but Jamie's love for the Constitution and for American democracy is really what's helping him get through this terrible, life-changing loss of Tommy.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Madeline Carter, and congratulations on this film. Again, it will appear on MSNBC 10 Eastern Time on Sunday night and then move on to Peacock. This is Democracy Now! Next up, we go to Chicago, where protests erupted Thursday over the early release of the ex-police officer Jason Van Dyke, who murdered 17-year-old Laquan McDonald in 2014, shooting him to death 16 times. Stay with us.
"41 shots, and we'll take that ride across this bloody river to the other side. 41 shots cut through the night. You're kneeling over his body in the vestibule, praying for his life. Where is it, a gun? Is it a knife? Is it a wallet? This is your life. It ain't no secret.
It ain't no secret.
A secret, my friend. You can't kill just for living in the American skin.
41 shots. 41 shots.
American Skin, 41 shots by Bruce Springsteen, the song inspired by the New York police shooting death of Amadou Diallo. On this day in 1999, February 4th, Amadou Diallo was killed in a hail of police bullets after cops mistook his wallet for a gun. Four officers fired 41 times, fatally hitting the 23-year-old Ghanaian immigrant 19 times. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In Chicago, the former police officer who murdered black teenager Laquan McDonald in 2014 walked free from prison Thursday. Jason Van Dyke, who's white, served a little over 3 years, less than half his nearly seven-year prison sentence, before being released for good behavior. Van Dyke shot 17-year-old Laquan McDonald 16 times, but the Chicago Police Department attempted to cover up the events with the help of then-Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Activists are now calling for federal charges against Van Dyke. Several protests took place in Chicago yesterday, including in front of Federal Plaza, where Reverend Jesse Jackson hand-delivered a letter to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago backing the call for federal charges. For more, we go to Chicago to speak with two activists who were detained and released last night after their protest in the lobby of the Federal Building Courthouse with others, including Laquan McDonald's grandma. Will Calloway is a Chicago community organizer, a violence interrupter who pushed for the release of the video that showed Van Dyke murdering McDonald. Also with us, Justin Blake, uncle of Jacob Blake, who was left paralyzed after he was shot by police officers in Kenosha, Wisconsin, as he was reaching in his car and his children, three of his children, looked on in the back seat. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Will Calloway, talk about what has happened. I mean, Jason Van Dyke was convicted of second-degree murder and 16 charges of aggravated battery for shooting Laquan McDonald 16 times. How did he get the seven-year sentence, and how did he get out with little over 3 years yesterday?
When it boils down to it, first of all, thanks for having us on this morning. And when it boils down to it, this is just a system that was created and designed to allow officers to kill African Americans with impunity and provide them this level and shield of protection. This is the manifestation of that. What Judge Gargan did on January 19, 2019, was that he decided to only sentence Jason Van Dyke for the second-degree murder count and completely ignore the 16 counts of aggravated battery, which in the state of Illinois carries 6 to 30 years for each count. The second-degree murder, unfortunately, only carried a minimally of probation up to 10 to 15 years. And that's what the jury convicted him of. He was convicted of second-degree murder and convicted of 16 counts of aggravated battery with a deadly weapon, with a firearm. And in the state of Illinois, that carries 6 to 30 if they was ran consecutively. But unfortunately, Judge Gargan decided not to sentence him appropriately. And this is what we was left with. 81 months was his sentence. He did a bare minimum of 3 years in prison, and now he's able to come home. It's individuals in Cook County Jail, several miles from where we're at right now. There's people in pretrial detention for nonviolent drug offenses that are in detention right now that have spent more time in the Cook County Jail than Jason Van Dyke has spent in the state penitentiary for murder. And that is a miscarriage of justice.
So talk about the call for federal charges. For people to understand, the McMichaels in Georgia, they went through a state trial. Then there's supposed to be a federal trial. They're trying to make a plea agreement there. You've got the police officers involved with the killing of George Floyd. You've got the state trial, and you've got the federal trial. Why weren't there federal charges brought against Jason Van Dyke, Will?
Right. Thank you for mentioning the situation in Georgia with Ahmaud Arbery and also the situation that happened with George Floyd as well. Those cases are the precedent that set. And even in Carolina in 2015 with ex-officer Michael Slager shooting Walter Scott, that you can federal charges are applicable. But when it comes to Laquan McDonald and Jason Van Dyke, listen, When Jason Van Dyke murdered Laquan McDonald several months after it happened, the U.S. Attorney Office then, under the Obama administration, Zach Farden was the United States District Attorney for our district. When he was in office, he specifically said he wanted to wait for the state trial to play out first, right? Because if he was to take over and the case went south, you wouldn't have been able to hold Jason Van Dyke accountable because of double jeopardy, right? So he wanted the state trial to play out first. But by time the state trial played out, which was 2018, October the 5th, we had a new presidential administration that made it abundantly clear that they was not going to hold police officers accountable. So basically, we have 4 years of a Department of Justice that did not actively have any civil rights probe investigations actively going for anything regarding police. So now here we are in 2021, 2022 with a new presidential administration, and that has to be reignited. And be reminded about this case with Laquan McDonald. So that's pretty much where we are. It was 4 years where this case was just completely tabled, and now we're trying to get a new administration.
Is it too late for federal charges to be brought? You have Laquan McDonald's grandmother, who was detained like you were last night, has called for President Biden to intervene. She said, come forward. We need your help. I need your help. Could federal charges be brought now?
Yes, absolutely. And again, for just a slight correction, she was detained and let go. We were arrested by U.S. Marshals. We were arrested and federally charged by U.S. Marshals yesterday. We had to appear before a federal judge last evening in order to be released out of federal custody. But to answer your question, there's no statute of limitations for this crime, because what Jason Van Dyke, as a result of what Jason Van Dyke did, resulted in the death of Laquan McDonald. Therefore, it's no statute of limitations on this.
Justin, I want to bring you back into this conversation. It was great having you recently with your brother, Jacob Blake, talking about your nephew, Jacob Blake. The officer in that case was not charged. But talk about why you were there last night. Again, you both have been arrested, charged federally. Jesse Jackson was there as well. Why is this critical to you?
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for having us again. My big brother sends his love to you. Why are we here? The Blake family wants to be all around this country and around the world participating and fight for justice for African Americans all over this globe. What happened here is unconscionable. To think that a young man was struck down with 16 bullets and he would have been shot with more if one of the officers didn't stop Van Dyke from reloading his gun. This is absurd. This is 2022. If anybody deserves rights, civil rights and liberties, African Americans should. We built this country. We made this country the richest country in the world for 400 years of free slavery. And the day is due where we're able to walk through the streets where we are taxpayers and pay the people that are harming us ends. And so we had to come back to our hometown to support my brother Will and the great work that he's done with this family, and to continue to keep the charge going and the torch lit that we need justice for this particular case. We have President Biden, who hasn't done anything. The Floyd family members, Breonna Taylor's family, Big Jake, we all feel like he's let us down and sold us out. How dare we talk about China and how they treat their people, human rights, when we in America have African Americans being gunned down in the street almost daily?
Let me ask Will Calloway. I mean, you have Rahm Emanuel, who's a former mayor of Chicago, involved with the cover-up of the murder of Laquan McDonald, now confirmed as the ambassador to Japan. But Will Calloway, yesterday, President Biden was in New York meeting with the new mayor, Adams, calling for an end to gun violence. You are called a violence interrupter. Explain what that is and your response to what it would mean to end gun violence in this country?
Great question. Well, for me, being a violence interrupter, what that includes is in my community, in South Shore, that's on the southeast side of the city. What we do is we engage or we try to mediate different gang conflicts or tension between different factions inside of our neighborhoods or in the surrounding neighborhoods in the city. And we try to mediate that conflict by face-to-face interactions, relationship building, mentor, big brother programs, finding a way to channel and funnel a lot of these young men and women out of a life of crime, out of the streets, and get them on a righteous trajectory. So we've had a lot of support. We've been highlighted by the Obama Foundation by the work that we do. But ultimately, it's going to take funding. We need resources in our community. We do not need in the African American community more policing. Scientifically, I think even the University of Chicago recently did a study. The crime lab showed that more police do not solve. Not only does it not solve crimes, but it's not preventative. It's reactionary. In order for us to be proactive, we need people that's in a community that has relationship with people in a community that will be at-risk gun offenders or possibly target of gun offenses. We need those people to be proactive and provide them with the resources so they can go out and methodically eradicate this gun violence. I'm for that, and I mean, Laquan McDonald was a victim of gun violence.
So
victim of gun violence by a Chicago police officer.
Will, but we thank you so much for being with us, Will Calloway and Justin Blake. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
WRCT, Pittsburgh. You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh and the Deep Blues Hour. My name is Steve. I'll be your host for 60 minutes of classic and traditional blues, coming right up. And in this hour, we're going to hear from David Honeyboy Edwards, singing about a howling wind back in 1969. From the same year, we're also going to hear from Sam Way performing live at the Ann Arbor Blues Festival with a well-covered, often-covered tune, plus Big Joe Williams singing about his Banta Rooster. Yeah, it's all coming up here on this hour of the Deep Blues Hour. We're going to start the show with Albert King, recording for Stax Records. This is That's What the Blues Is All About. Indeed, Albert King on the Deep Blues Hour.
All that's what the blues is, people. whistle for my dog. He ran up under the house, people, like he didn't even know me at all. Now I hadn't fed him in 2 or 3 days, and he was looking kind of thin. Oh, when your dog turned your back on you, buddy, you know you haven't even got a friend. That's the blues.